Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first cases for this morning are Dennis against, In re Dennis, appeal of the Illinois Department of Human Services, and the consolidated case. So, Mr. Lynch.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, my name is Robert Lynch. I represent the appellants in these consolidated cases, the Illinois Department of Human Services. As a preliminary matter, I would like to briefly explain the importance of these matters to both the bankruptcy court and to the Department of Human Services. In 2019 alone, the Department of Human Services has filed so far over 40 priority claims asserting domestic support obligation priority. They expect that number will be well over 100 claims for this year alone. In response to those claims, the Department of Human Services has received over a dozen objections from debtors, similar to the objections present in Dennis.
How many of those claims were overpayments, like here, as opposed to payments that had been on assignment or direct support payments?
These are all overpayment claims. So these are debts that are virtually identical to the debts that are at issue in this case.
So why is it, in the absence of any allegation of misconduct on the part of the debtors, that these somehow have the character of support payments when they're just a debt at this point? I don't see where the department is drawing the line. Suppose, for example, somebody has children in the household and they're receiving some form of disability assistance. Maybe they're receiving workers' comp, or maybe they're receiving some form of disability, and it's overpaid. So the household has too much money, and then there's an effort to recoup the overpayment when the error is found. And again, as here, no question of fraud, no question of misconduct. Would you say that's a support payment?
No, Your Honor. I would not say that that's a support payment.
So tell me where the line is, because I certainly don't see it in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the statute here, which is Section 101.14a of the Bankruptcy Code, and you read it with respect to debts owed to governmental units, the statute provides that a domestic support obligation means a debt that is owed to or recoverable by a governmental unit.
Right. Now, we know what it says, and actually the word support obligation is one that has a pretty well-recognized, or the phrase support obligation, pretty well-recognized meaning in the law of domestic relations, and you certainly aren't trying to support the debtors in these cases. You're trying to take money away from them to diminish the support that will go to the relevant dependent children at this stage of the game. Because as the bankruptcy judge put it, you're trying to recover a debt owed for the return of benefits that never should have been paid at all. So you're trying to get, in essence, the non-support portion of the benefits.
What the department is seeking to recover in these cases is that's correct. These
the
are,
non-support part, the part that should not have been paid at all, which you say is somehow a support payment.
The department's position that those are support payments is because we're looking at the original obligation, that is the grant of support.
Right, and how many layers do we look through? Because I take it the department concedes that on its face, this is not an effort to recover support payments. This is, in fact, an effort to collect a debt that went at the time the debt was incurred reflected a mistake in the calculation of support payments. Had you not made the mistake, the debt would never have been there.
That is correct. If the mistake had not been made,
it has nothing to do with support, actually. It has to do with a mistake. I mean, it could have been a mistaken payment for a rent subsidy. It could have been a mistaken payment for assistance in medical benefits. It could have been anything.
The distinction the department draws from those other debts that you have just mentioned are that the programs that provide these benefits for which they were overpaid were providing support to the debtor for their children.
When the money goes back, does the department use it for domestic support obligations in some other context, or does it just go back into a pool of money that might go out for something else?
It goes back into the pool of money that's going to be used to fund these programs.
So let's take SNAP. You provide people SNAP benefits who don't have a single child. It could be an intact family, husband and wife. You wouldn't call that a support payment. Most of your SNAP payments are not.
Where the household does not have a child as part of the application, we would concede that those would not be a domestic support.
Right, and so if you recoup for the SNAP program, which is the one of these two cases, to answer Judge St. Eve's question, it's just going to go back into a pool of money that may or may not have anything to do with support.
It would go back into a pool of money that would be used to fund the SNAP program.
Correct, which is not linked to support. Sometimes SNAP benefits help children because they are members of the family and they eat, but it's not a support program in the sense of domestic relations support. It doesn't have anything to do with alimony or support or child support from one spouse or one parent to the other.
In response to that, DHS would say that the statute itself does not speak to support in the sense that it must be required as a replacement for child support. DHS position is that the benefits that were provided that gave rise to the overpayment were in the nature of support. And the statute supports that where the governmental unit is the claimant, that for a debt that's owed directly to or recoverable back to that governmental unit, that you must look at the original obligation that gave rise to that support.
Let's look at 101.14a. I'm not sure that you are, I don't know where you get that understanding of the term domestic support obligation. If you look at the statute as a whole, and there are cumulative requirements, one of which is it has to be in the nature of alimony, maintenance, or support, including assistance provided by a governmental unit of such spouse, former spouse, or child of the debtor, or such, blah, 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 blah. So I'm not sure your narrow reading is, or maybe it's an overly broad reading, I'm not sure, but I don't know where you get your reading from. You don't think that section means anything?
Yes, but when read in conjunction with subparagraphs A and B together, in order for a debt to be owed directly to a governmental unit, the debt itself would not necessarily be in the nature of support of either the child or that governmental unit.
No, I don't read that way at all, because the word and appears after C. These are four cumulative requirements. It has to be owed to a particularly designated entity or individual. It has to be in the nature of alimony, maintenance, or support. It has to be established at a certain time, and it can't be assigned to a non-governmental entity. All of those things have to be met.
Correct.
And so you are eliminating capital B.
DHS does not believe that it's eliminated capital B. It believes.
How are you following it when you say it doesn't really have to be support?
If you read Section 101.14a definition in conjunction with Section 507a, which is the provision that gives priority to domestic support obligation claims, that section kind of further defines the universe of domestic support obligation, the types of claims that would make up domestic support obligations. And it clearly separates the debts under 507a into two separate broad categories. The first category under subparagraph A would be those debts that are owed directly to a support creditor, whether or not the claim has been filed by that support creditor or by a governmental unit collecting on behalf of that support creditor. In subparagraph B, there's a second category of debts that are generally claims of governmental units.
But sometimes governmental units provide direct support, so they're not collecting on behalf of an individual person. I know that there are systems in which a support obligation funnels through the government and back out again to the recipient. But I'm not sure why this helps you.
And this section defines domestic support obligation in terms of a debt, not the original obligation. And the debt here, it's uncontroverted that it was based on an overpayment, so based on a mistake. So the amount owed back, the debt, is this overpayment amount. It's not a domestic support obligation on its own.
That is correct, however.
So then how do you get around a plain reading of the statute that talks about debt when this amount is just an overpayment? It's not in the nature of support that's going back to the agency.
Again, as I've answered Judge Wood, the position of DHS, which is supported by the bankruptcy decisions that have found that these types of debts are domestic support obligations, and supported by the Tenth Circuit's rationale in the Taylor decision, is that where their direct debts owed to a governmental unit, the statute dictates that the court look to the underlying obligation. And I would just like to turn the attention back to 507A1B to explain that in the first half of that section applies to assignment debts, where the second half applies to debts that are owed directly to or recoverable by a governmental unit. If debts that are owed to claims for a government debt for services that have been previously provided and now they're seeking payment could not qualify as domestic support obligations because they themselves lacked a nature of support going forward.
Now, you would never have a burden, would you, of going to the provision that allows you to recover a debt when there was fraud? It would just kind of erase that part of the bankruptcy code. Why would you ever bother to do that if you could just sue under the theory you're now advancing?
Well, here both provisions of 523, and you're referring to 523A2 for fraud.
Right, 523. You would never need a 523A2 proceeding if you can just get it as an overpayment automatically.
Yes, where the
debt. So you're kind of reading that out.
We could proceed under both categories. And
but you wouldn't, because it's a higher burden of proof under 523A2. You have to show that there's the fraud.
Right, and we would not have to show fraud if the debt's qualified.
Right.
As
medical
fraud.
Right.
At this time,
if you would like to save a bit, you're welcome
to do that. Thank you. I'd like to save the rest of my time for a vote.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Ms. Margolit?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Anat Margolit of Legal Assistance Foundation, and I represent the debtor Appellee Tyanne Halbert. I would like to touch on Your Honor Judge Wood's first question as to where to draw the line when you are determining whether there is a domestic support obligation. The appellee asserts that the line should be drawn as to whether there is a domestic support obligor who has fallen behind on his obligations. That test or line fits with the plain language of the statute, the policy of reprobation of an absent parent or an absent domestic support obligor who has a requirement to support his children, and it fits with the legislative history.
But how do you bring back in Congress's deliberate decision to single out governmental entities as potential participants in the support?
So the reason that the statute was amended for governmental to sort of it appears to expand the for governmental units, but it does not, is because there was a split among the courts leading up to the 2005 amendments, where the statute clearly discussed assigned child support obligations, but did not discuss those that were directly owed to the government. And there was a division among the courts regarding domestic support.
How frequently does that come up, where such an obligation is directly owed to the government? It looks like it's in very rare circumstances. And Rivera touched on some of them, but it looked very narrow.
Right. In the state of Illinois, if you have a child in foster care, the state can, and I'm not talking about someone who already has a child support order entered where he is the obligor, but if you are the parent who the child was just taken from you and placed in care of the state can turn to you directly and ask for payment for that child that is in foster care. So that would be a perfect example of the amount directly owed. The number
does
of times...
Does it vary by state?
I'm sorry?
It sounds to me from your answer that Illinois may have one set of circumstances where this language would be triggered, but maybe other states would have others.
I believe it's a federal requirement it does
right,
come
but the way, I guess what I was trying to say is the way some states structure their child support network, this language might come into play more often or not.
I don't know other states.
Okay.
But I will say that when you look at the cases that where there was the split, those cases the subject of matter of those cases was frequently foster care. I think there's one where it was a ward of the state, but most of them are foster care.
Mm-hmm. Your client was the person who, I'm just trying to remember, is the SNAP client, right?
Yes.
Who was getting these general benefits.
Yes.
Why isn't that a support payment for a child? It goes to food, right?
Because there isn't an absent parent. It doesn't replace an absent parent. And the policy behind a domestic support obligation, again, is some sort of reprobation of those domestic support obligors that fall behind on their duty. Mm-hmm. And when Ms. Halbert was overpaid food stamps, she was not falling behind on her duty to care for her children. She herself, she's not an absent parent. She's a low-income debtor. She herself is a child support
And would it matter
recipient
if those initial payments were for domestic support, given that the overpayment, the money's going back, it may not be used for domestic support? Does it matter what that original payment is for, under your theory?
I don't think it does.
You just look at the debt portion?
Well, I mean, we assert that food stamps is not a domestic support obligation and that the overpayment is certainly not a domestic support obligation. But your honors don't need to decide, you know, if you decide that an overpayment is not domestic support, you don't need to decide. But it would be helpful to draw the line somewhere for these types of issues going forward, because it hasn't been, there's no other court that has really decided this.
So if I understand your theory correctly, there's a universe out there of public assistance benefits, many of which are provided by the states, and only a subset, in your view, would count as child support or support payments of some type, not necessarily housing or food stamps or, you know, whatever, SNAP.
Only where there's an absent parent or spouse who has fallen behind on his obligations to pay.
Essentially, this language that we were talking about earlier in capital letter B of 101.14a, in the nature of alimony, maintenance, or support. Right.
Yes. I will go to some of my remarks if your honors don't have any more questions.
Yeah.
The state's casting of itself as a domestic support creditor in these sorts of situations is injurious to the most vulnerable individuals of our society. The state is putting itself in the shoes of those that are actually in need of support,
So let me ask you this question. Overpayments, if there were no bankruptcy, I'll put it this way, so in the non-bankruptcy context, if there's an overpayment, the state has a way of recouping those funds. It can reduce future payments or it can take other steps, right?
Yes, exactly.
So in the bankruptcy context, your argument is that this is a dischargeable debt?
Yes. And in Ms. Halbert's case, they took her tax refund. So they have a lot of, you know, besides setting off, they use TOP to set off her tax refund.
And of course, this case is live because she could still get it back, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Treating a food stamps overpayment as a domestic support obligation does not serve to benefit children or punish delinquent obligors. It would, however, retract needed funds from a family with children. The implications of recognition as a domestic support obligation are far-reaching. Essentially, if an individual, through no fault of his own, is overpaid by the state and has children, that individual cannot use bankruptcy to get relief from that debt, no matter what his financial situation is. For these reasons, domestic support does not include general welfare benefits granted by the state to low-income families. DHS's interpretation is the one that could lead to expansive results. Would unemployment benefits, the earned income tax credit, or educational scholarships that are overpaid become domestic support if there are children in the household? A misclassification of overpayment debt as a domestic support obligation compromises the goals of the underlying public benefits by preventing the benefits of a bankruptcy from those most in need and impairing those
that
are...
All this appears in your brief, doesn't it?
Yes.
Why are you reading it?
I can finish my remarks if there are no more questions.
You may do that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Margulies. Mr. Miller.
Good morning. Michael Miller on behalf of the appellee, Devon Dennis. One remark I'd like to touch on is you had asked, why isn't it support if there's food that's being given by SNAP? And as my co-appellee answered, it's because there's no nexus to the debtor's failure to meet a family support obligation.
But what about your client? This was a child care program, right?
It was a subsidy for daycare, yes.
Right, for daycare. That sounds like supporting a child to me. It's not a family bait, you know, it's not like food in the refrigerator.
Right. We don't argue that there wasn't a benefit and the benefit wasn't to the child, just like with the link. But as Rivera pointed out, the benefit was incidental and it was just for some ordinary and general support that happened to benefit a dependent. And that is stretching it way too far, the way DHS is going, where they're saying, well, heck, any benefit, if there's a dependent in the household, should become a DSO.
But you are disputing that it's a DSO in the first instance, aren't you?
Yes.
That the initial payment...
Yes.
You are disputing
that. We dispute that as well. We dispute that it's just a public subsidy that the state did not step in and provide daycare in place of the debtor who is not supporting her obligation. And this casual incidental benefit is not enough to rise to the level of a DSO.
And then where would you draw the line on where a DSO should be defined?
Well, in an overpayment of benefits, our position is the same, that it doesn't matter if the original debt was child support, if the overpayment is nothing more than a debt. But, you know, our position is DHS doesn't prevail either way. Even if you want to go back and look at the initial debt, it's still not in the nature of support.
Where would you draw the line in looking at the initial debt and making a determination if the initial debt is covered by a domestic support obligation?
As the Riviera case pointed out, and also the supplement from Collier, there has to be a nexus to the debtor's failure to meet a family support obligation. So it's got to be the debtor failed to do something, such as foster care, residential treatment centers, sometimes governmental expenses for custody, and then wardship, all the examples that were pointed out by Riviera. And it is a narrow category. And let's also remember that BAPSIPA is only 14 years old. And as my co-counsel pointed out, prior to 2005, this kind of issue came up all the time, but courts kind of said, oh, governmental entity, not a payee, but BAPSIPA resolved that split by making the governmental governmental unit a payee now.
When it was actually providing support,
yes.
As opposed to running a general public assistance program.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to, the policies of the bankruptcy code and the U.S. Supreme Court also support our analysis. The Bullock case said exceptions to discharge should be narrowly construed in favor of the debtor's fresh start. DHS's position is nothing but narrow. It's overgeneralized. And also, priority creditors should be narrowly construed to not dilute the value Congress gives to these kind of creditors that they prefer. So DHS position completely circumvents these very important policies. And as your honor said, they do have the right to come in and file a 523A2A action. They can use recoupment. There's other ways to make these debtors whole.
And I take it there's no hint of that, of any ground for a 523A action here.
Correct.
That this was just a mistake in calculation and it needed to be fixed, and that was that.
Correct. And they never brought it up, and the deadlines passed for objections. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, is in terms of like opening the floodgates, as you have talked about, the floodgates could be opened for all these kind of overpayment bets. But the other thing you have to keep in mind is if DHS wins, you also could have governmental creditors just coming in. Not overpayments, but governmental creditors. What about like a medical bill owed to a state hospital like Stroger? Your child goes there. They have a surgery for $10,000. Now they need to file a bankruptcy, and Stroger comes in and says, that was support for your child. That's the problem. They're going to open the floodgates. And then another example could be a water bill to the city of Chicago. That supports your child. That supports your dependent. This is a governmental debt that they could say is in the nature of support. So I feel like the line could really be crossed if this court reverses.
And so you are advocating the same line as your co-counsel, that it has to do with replacing an absent parent who would otherwise be contributing to the support of the family unit.
Yes, and we feel that's supported by the Riviera case.
Or spouse, I might say.
Yeah, any dependent.
Alimony maintenance.
Right,
in there.
Right. Yeah. And just because there's some sort of incidental benefit that happened to get a benefit to the dependent doesn't rise to the level of DSO. Mm-hmm. So for the foregoing reasons, we ask this court should affirm the bankruptcy court.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Lynch, you may finish up.
Mr. Lynch, how do you respond to the floodgates argument that Mr. Miller just made?
Yes.
In particular, going outside of DHS.
Correct. Here, the position that DHS has taken in terms of where we set the periphery of where these claims would fall seems to be a question that the other side has raised. And it was a concern of the bankruptcy court as well, that this would somehow impermissibly extend to any conceivable debt. However, the position of DHS is that the debt that was issued here in the nature of support still is required to be part of, and this is a term used in Rivera, part of the family support infrastructure. In Rivera, they were discussing specifically foster care and wardship programs because the dispute there had to do with whether juvenile detention qualified. So they were comparing both of those programs. Here we would submit that the programs issued by DHS under SNAP and the Child Care Assistance Program fall within this sort of infrastructure that the state has.
So all family support can be reduced to alimony maintenance and support? Anything that supports whatever a family is?
Where?
So if you're a person who lives alone, I guess it's not family support. But if there's another person living in the household or more people, then it is?
Yes, but it's not that broad. The obligation still has to have to be founded in the traditional nature of support to the child. And in food stamps, it's providing the family with the ability to buy food.
What about the medical assistance hypothetical that Mr. Miller suggested? Surely a parent provides for medical assistance for her children.
Where it's simply a bill from the county, as Mr. Miller had articulated, and not something that arose out of a support program, then it would not necessarily be in the nature of support.
But what if the person is entitled to use the county facility precisely because of their limited income? Why isn't that support? It's medical support. It's Medicaid.
In that case, it may be a situation where it could, if the grant of support fell within the confines of this infrastructure, then it would be in support. And outside of these debts, there could be other debts, but it doesn't necessarily extend to infinity. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.